Morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Our next matter on our calendar for oral argument is Bren Road versus Talon OP, Talon's Chris Wyrobek, Kaminsky et al. While you're getting settled, there are two appellants in this case, so you will both need to be...
Your Honor, these were consolidated appeals, which actually had kind of a housekeeping question, is whether or not the court will permit each of the respective appellants their individual 15 minutes, or if we need to split that time.
That's what I was just getting to. You will need to split the time, just as you would if there were two respondents in a case. So should I presume you're going to split it equally between the two of you, or...?
Does the court know who we get to call first for the appellants, whether it's like the Wyrobek party versus the party?
First appellant listed is Chris Wyrobek, so I would go in that order.
Great.
Will that alter how you are dividing the time, or...?
We'll do our best to split it evenly here.
Because we will set the timer 7.5 a piece then,
great.
So you will...
Okay, so
you
we'll
know.
Set it 7.5.
Yep,
Wonderful.
We are able to do that.
Okay.
All right, so again, welcome to everyone. As you get ready, I'll just remind you of our procedures. You will each have, again, the respondent will have one of you arguing, I assume, and you will have 15 minutes. Appellants will have 15 minutes to present their arguments, splitting the time equally. Appellants will also have 5 minutes for rebuttal, and I'm not sure how you want to divide that time, but knowing that ahead of time will be helpful for our marshal.
If I may, Your Honor?
You may.
Before we get to rebuttal, just have approximately 15 seconds to discuss between us what we may do for allocation on the clock.
Why don't we do this? We'll just set the 5-minute timer, and I will let you both decide it on the fly, understanding that if one of you talks for 5 minutes, the other one won't get to talk.
Fair enough.
All right.
Yep.
It's also important that you each identify who you represent and state your name when you begin your arguments, and podium can be raised and lowered with a button that's under the center. And with that, counsel for Appellant Wyrobek. You may proceed, and the timer is set for you, so you may proceed.
Okay. May it please the court, counsel. My name is John Bazans. I am counsel for Appellant Christian Wyrobek. Mr. Wyrobek was the director of a public company called Talon Real Estate Holding Corp., which I'll refer to as TREC today, that was the general partner for a limited partnership called Talon OPLP. He was held personally liable for a $14.5 million judgment for acts primarily committed by Mr. M.G. Kaminsky, acts and omissions by Mr. Kaminsky, on theories of fraudulent omission and aiding and abetting fiduciary duty. Case, of course, was tried at the Hennepin County District Court, and the court made several reversible errors, and we asked this court to reverse the trial court, dismiss the claims against Mr. Wyrobek, and vacate the judgment. Starting on the fraud by omission claim, this claim, of course, has four elements. This claim has four elements. Concealing a fact material to a transaction, within the concealing party's knowledge, the concealing party knows that the other party to the transaction is acting as if it doesn't know that. Yes, Your Honor.
Would you agree that any error on the fraud by omission claim would be harmless unless we find that the aiding and abetting breach of fiduciary duty claim is also erroneous?
I'm not sure that's true, Your Honor, because if the aiding and abetting claim is erroneous and it's vacated, I presume that the fraud claim could still arguably remain. And therefore, Mr. Wyrobek would still be on the hook for the judgment. So I think both of these...
I'm just saying if we agree with you on the fraud by omission, that was erroneous, what the court found in favor...
If fraud by omission was erroneous,
yes.
Then does the aiding and abetting claim, is that effectively mooted?
No, it's not that it's mooted, but it's the same award for both, right?
It's the same award, but the court found that he was liable on both of them. The aiding and abetting is not a tort. It's a theory of liability, so he was held liable for the 14.5, no matter whether he committed a fraud or if he just aided and abetted. So the fourth element is whether or not the concealing party had a legal or equitable duty to communicate the fact. The trial court got these elements right in the findings of fact and conclusions of law. And prior to trial, it applied it correctly with respect to Mr. Agar, who was a board member. And the court determined that Bren Road failed to establish a transaction, and that is elemental to the very first element of this claim.
The court made some very significant findings of fact as it related to the dismissal of Agar. Is that how it's pronounced?
That's correct.
He's out, but he's there out. Was some significant findings of fact. So we don't concern ourselves with him, but as it relates to the aiding and abetting, seems to be quite damaging to your client, the string of emails between Agar and your client, as well as the I think it was a note or an email to self that Agar had in his own testimony that he warned your client on numerous occasions to do something about this.
Your Honor, Mr. Agar did have opinions as to whether or not Trek was being properly controlled by Mr. Kaminsky, but that knowledge of various facts does not necessarily mean that Mr. Wyrobek had actual knowledge that Mr. Kaminsky was doing any of these with a wrongful purpose. And that's where the error arises.
What's our standard of review on that? I mean, we're looking at the evidence that came in, which was the testimonial evidence as well as the emails that were submitted. So what do we do with that in the trial court's findings?
The standard is de novo. Whether or not the findings of fact support the conclusions of law is a legal question and therefore requires de novo review. So the court does not need to defer to the trial court's findings on this. So for a couple of reasons, Your Honor, a lot of the purported knowledge was about incidents that occurred even before Mr. Wyrobek was on the board. The aiding and abetting is of the fiduciary duty claim, and many of the acts found by the trial court were acts that occurred before Mr. Wyrobek joined the board. So even if he found out about it, these issues, he cannot in turn substantially assist those from having occurred. They already occurred.
Well, there were certainly things that occurred after 2016, including the $23 million that somehow disappeared after the Gamma loan transaction. I mean, and your client was on board at that point.
That's true, Your Honor. There was knowledge of these various facts having occurred. But what Bren Road did not prove and what the trial court's findings don't conclude is that Mr. Wyrobek had actual knowledge that any of these acts had a wrongful purpose. The fact that $23 million went missing, there's no evidence that Mr. Wyrobek had any knowledge where it went or who did anything with it, or that he even substantially assisted that $23 million from disappearing. That's not in the record.
Didn't he have an obligation, though, because of his position, a director position, to look into that? Isn't that what Agar said? Is like, this is my responsibility, this is to the shareholders? I mean, why would we not go with that?
A director of a corporate general partner has fiduciary duties to the shareholders of that corporation, to Trek. Mr. Wyrobek did not have an individual fiduciary duty to disclose material information, whether it's material or immaterial, on an ongoing basis to Bren Road. It's a limited partner. You'll see that in the Vincent v. Beck case in the concurrence, where the court says very clearly that officers of corporate general partners do not owe direct fiduciary duties to the limited partners. It's woven into effectively both of them, because the court essentially found that Mr. Wyrobek had this kind of ongoing obligation to disclose facts. But the reality is that disclosure obligation only arises in the course of a transaction, and he does not have a fiduciary duty of disclosure to Bren Road. He's not a party to a transaction with any of them, and the court, state of Minnesota, does not hold. You'll never find a case that says that a director of a corporate general partner owes a fiduciary duty directly to the limited partner.
But and I understand the case law you're relying on for that proposition, but that, to get back to a prior question, the aiding and abetting claim doesn't turn on your client owing a particular fiduciary duty.
It does
correct?
Not. It does not. It requires a showing of substantial assistance
and
knowledge of the wrongful purpose. And what the court should look at is a lot of the actions that Mr. Kaminsky was found to have violated his fiduciary duty were ones that did not occur when Mr. Wyrobek was on the board, or there was no evidence that he had any knowledge of them, and there was no evidence that he substantially assisted. Inaction under Minnesota law is insufficient to demonstrate substantial assistance. You have to take an affirmative step that has a substantial factor in bringing about the bad act.
And so just to be clear, I know you're out of time. is your argument on this essentially that the district court reached erroneous legal conclusions on this rather than making clearly erroneous findings of fact?
Erroneous legal, yes. It erred as a matter of law in holding that that Mr. Wyrobek defrauded or aided and abetted.
Thank you.
With that, I'm out of time.
You will have some amount of time
okay.
to be determined later for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning. Again, may it please the court and counsel, I'm Daniel Gallatin. I am here representing a number of folks, those being Talon OP, Talon Real Estate Holding, Talon Bren Road, 5130 Industrial, 1350 Bud, Talon Management Services, Talon Hotels, Talon Antigua, First Tracks, Brenda and Matthew Kaminsky, and also the Kaminsky Trust.
We'll just call you the Talon Appellant. I mean, that's easy, right?
As long as we're careful with who is within the scope of that.
Well, and I was going to ask about what relief you're actually seeking on appeal, because I know you represent all these parties, you know, and some of the representation has changed as between trial and here. But I read your brief, and it seems to be more focused on relief sought by Brenda Kaminsky, First Tracks. I mean, figure out what you're asking this court for?
Well, Your Honor, as always, is well prepared and versed on it. The fact is, I didn't file the representation as to who is appealing on this. And you're exactly right as far as reading it. The relief being sought is with respect to Matthew Kaminsky, Brenda Kaminsky, First Tracks, and then on some specific items, the judgment award amount, though.
Did you say court intervention? We don't know what you want us to do. Court intervention or to see that justice is rendered or words to that effect. I don't have it in front of me. But what are you asking us to do?
First off, with respect to the motion to dismiss that was granted at the outset, that motion, I represent, Your Honor, was wrongly granted in favor of the Bren Road party. The substantial error that was made comes in a couple of different forms. Number one, there is, of course, we have a very simple standard for what we have to plead. In the motion to dismiss, we get as the non-moving party, the legal benefit of what we've stated in the complaint is taken as true. In deciding the motion, though, what we saw Judge Sandy do is he, number one, didn't accept it as true, that even though it was pled, there's a recognized market which these can be sold in. What he concludes as the basis for rejecting is that you didn't prove there was a sale. But that's not what it is. The 336.911 exception only identifies that there's an available market.
But isn't the availability of a market a legal conclusion that would be based on facts you would believe to support the conclusion by the district court that there is an available market?
So that exception within the 336, I think, constitutes a blend of this is the standard. The fact within the standard is that there's a recognized market. And given that we're at the stage of a motion to dismiss and we're only looking at putting the other party on notice of, here's the exception that we're pursuing, and we state as a fact there is a recognized market in which these securities could be sold.
Well, what are the facts that show that there's a recognized market, that being the recognized market being a legal conclusion that we would have to draw to deny?
Well, that's where I assert the allegation that's pled is a factual allegation, not a legal conclusion. The legal conclusion might be something to the effect of there was a breach of contract. That, to me, constitutes a legal conclusion. But what's stated, though, in the complaint is that there is an existence of a market as a matter of fact. It's not the legal conclusion that there's a recognized or available market. It's that factually it is the case there is a market. Because it's a statement of fact as to the existence of the market. It's the situation, though, that fact satisfies the exception. It's not that the fact as alleged constitutes the legal conclusion. It is the fact that calls for the exception to be applicable. So, in other words, could there have been, say, yes, we can go down to 25 Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard where they sell these and sell them. That could have been pled, something to that effect, perhaps, yes. Which would be another fact that supports the existence of the exception. But I just think
these were units that weren't sold publicly, right? They were town OP units that
The interesting part and the difficulty with that is that while the factual requirement was pled, it got truncated in the ability to further expose the availability of that market, who could buy it, what the values were, and all that sort of thing, which is exactly why the standard for a motion to dismiss is so onerous on the moving party. You deprive the other side, if granted, from going from, we're putting you on notice in our complaint that this is our train of thought. You're taking it from there and then saying, this now in the course of litigation, experts, deposition, interrogatories or whatnot, we're going to further explore and justify this factual allegation. By virtue of the granting of the motion to dismiss, that was all taken away. And that then had a substantial effect on the downflow of the resulting litigation. Because now we don't have a spot where another party is on notice through the complaint about, hey, look, we don't think you have standing to be here. Here's our factual complaint. There is a market. Through this issue, we're going to go down now, and we're going to show you don't have a right to sue us anymore. You don't have a right to be here. They should have gotten the opportunity to explore that on a motion to dismiss of all things.
Can I ask you a different question? One of the arguments you advance on appeal is that the district court erred by extending the spoliation sanction to First Tracks. What can you point to in the district court's order that would show any prejudice to First Tracks as a that the district court actually did that, other than the one reference to just Talon defendants generally? But what would you point to in the order that shows that first that the court applied that to First Tracks and to its prejudice?
So how that relates, Your Honor, within the scope of the subsequent arguments that we have on here is that the prejudice and negative inference that the court took out of that spoliation sanction permeated through down to the piercing of the corporate veil elements. Because by virtue of saying, okay, look, we're putting the spoliation sanction on you, First Tracks and Brenda Kaminsky, there's a complete void of any of the Victoria Elevator factors that follow. Those Victoria Elevator factors predominantly are proven through documentation. So how you get to a spot in an order that you're going to say, we're piercing the veil and putting you on the hook for $14.5 million, even though we are not going to spend one half of one page or one word on any of the Victoria Elevator elements, is you extend the spoliation sanction. If that's the case, then what you end up with is a plain old blanket. The judges didn't do anything to analyze Victoria Elevator. So what I'm saying is, if there was a reliance on the spoliation sanction as an extension through the Victoria Elevator analysis, let's say that didn't happen, which it's worse. Now you have completely disregarded Victoria Elevator. Victoria Elevator is extraordinarily clear in its sentence. The Victoria Elevator factors are the threshold before you get to a determination of whether it's equitable, unjust, et cetera.
All right. Counsel, your time has expired.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you very much.
Counsel for respondents.
Sorry, let me gather my belongings. All right. May it please the court, Michael Stinson on behalf of Respondent Bren Road, LLC. As a threshold matter, Your Honors, and it's obvious you're all very prepared here today, I respectfully submit that this court should affirm the findings of fact, conclusions of law, and judgment of the trial court in its entirety. These issues that are being raised are predominantly issues centered around Judge Sandy's findings of fact that are entitled to substantial deference. Those findings include findings that Mr. Kaminsky operated the Talon entities as mere instruments and facades for his personal dealings and wrongdoing, that the corporate veil that may otherwise exist in respect and adherence to a corporate form as a separate person recognized under the law should not apply, that it was a facade.
I understand that with respect to Mr. Kaminsky, but the district court's analysis of the piercing argument with respect to Brenda Kaminsky seems a bit sparse, and that is certainly what we heard in the argument of appellants. How do you respond to their arguments?
Well, my understanding is that the court made numerous express findings of fact, and the evidence supported this, that Brenda Kaminsky was affected, obviously is married to M.G. Kaminsky, was used and participated squarely in the scheme here to operate as effectively a conduit for a sham entity, First Tracks, to siphon off these guarantor fees, was an intended beneficiary along with MG in tandem as husband-wife to benefit from the pilfering and outright theft of the only actual equity contribution ever made to the Talon entities, which was my client's contribution of the Bren Road property. Those findings include findings. One moment.
Well, when I'm looking at the court's findings, there seems to be sort of a conclusory finding that all the Victoria elevator factors are met without tying it to specific evidence vis-a-vis Brenda Kaminsky. What I guess is the strongest evidence admitted at trial that would link?
So there's evidence that the Kaminsky family, largely through Brenda Kaminsky, owned dominant control of Trek, that First Tracks was dominantly owned by Brenda. There's testimony from Mr. Agar that First Tracks had no actual business purpose or operation, had no actual business assets. There's the emails in the record that you already alluded to regarding these sham guarantor fees and Mr. Agar's objections, noting that the purpose was to siphon money to the Kaminsky, quote, family, including express reference to MG and Brenda. We've already paid MG and Brenda $750K. I'm not giving MG and Brenda another dime. It's more likely than not. I think the district court drew the fair inference that Brenda Kaminsky was a direct intended beneficiary, that she was, to the extent she had Trek stock and could exercise control of it, she was a conduit or puppet for her husband, for M.G. Kaminsky, and that they were operating in tandem, and therefore should be equally and coextensively liable. And all of that evidence and those findings are absolutely consistent with the record, the other findings of fact, and the evidence presented at trial.
I'll look it up after the fact. What findings are you referring to in the district court order? I thought you had them in front of you. If you were just reciting generally what it was, that's fine.
As far as findings go,
on the piercing.
On piercing, I don't have those right in front. The specific Brenda ones, I don't have in front of me. I can cite.
Don't waste your time on that. I'll look
okay.
For it after this hearing.
Yeah, the Fetus family emails referenced at 101, and that's in our addendum at 22.
Thank you.
December 15 transcript, Mr. Agar's testimony about First Tracks not having any actual business operations, that's at page 40 of that transcript.
Mr. Weyerbeck says in his reply brief that we should take pause because he was found liable for a $14.5 million judgment jointly and separately liable for it. You heard his attorney argue that many of the acts that resulted in that judgment occurred before he ever came to join the talent entities. Why should we not have pause and firm here?
This case is really all about the terminus event. The fact remains that the Bren Road property appreciated significantly. Real estate properties in general appreciated significantly in the interim while Mr. Kaminsky was using Talon as his, quote, personal toy. The testimony from Mr. Agar, the story he told that the court had found very credible, was that when this gamma loan transacted, with Mr. Weyerbeck's knowledge and active participation, that to get to this end game result for the Kaminskys and to protect his best friend of 30 years, MG, that had that money actually come in and been used to pay creditors, to conduct operations, it was all mapped out. Everything was going to be cash flow positive. Everything was perfect. It would have been fine. And the plaintiff's equity investment would have been protected, preserved, and appreciated. But instead, that, as we know, that $23 million disappeared. 5 months later, they did another $2 million needless refi transaction on the Bren Road property over Mr. Agar's objection, took another $150,000 guarantor fee for MG and his wife. The $2 million disappeared. That's $25 million total. The damages here were limited just to and as further to show you, this is an injury about Bren Road's injury. The damages here weren't for the $25 million that disappeared. The damages here were for the $14.5 million that would have been the value of Bren Road's equity contribution, but for this egregious wrongful conduct that occurred with this gamma loan and then the subsequent refi, where all of that money left, and then everything was left basically as a terminus event, just abandoned all operation. It's in the wind, it's a shell. That's how you get to the 14 and a half, and that's why Mr. Weyerbeck is on the hook for the whole thing.
The way you describe it raises, in my mind, the question of whose claims were these? Are these direct claims, or are they derivative claims? Seems to me that Weyerbeck makes a strong argument that the injury alleged has always been injuries to the various corporate entities. Why is he wrong?
So the question of this direct v. derivative question, I think is a bit, on its surface it may have appeal, but it's a bit of a red herring if we actually dig into the case law and how it's developed in circumstance.
That said, you did argue futility to the district court, but you didn't brief that particular argument. Is there any reason you didn't pursue that?
I'm not able to really answer that question. I will say that in seeing the arguments as presented on appeal, that it crystallized that this was a standing issue they were raising. And so we responded in kind, where their contention is this is a real party and interest issue, standing issue. If we look at the actual case law, starting with Medtronic, that is really, you know, lays out the Minnesota standard conclusively, the question, of course, is whether or not we look to who suffered the injury and therefore who's entitled to recovery. The rule derives from the really just real party and interest doctrine and the general principle that, quote, as an entity distinct from its stockholders, a corporation holds the separate right to sue in its own name. In other words, where there's a legitimate corporate entity that suffers injury, then we respect the personhood, the separate distinction of that entity. The case law is also well developed, however. There is no injury to an entity that is doomed or intended for terminus anyway. When the breach of fiduciary duty in question...
That's what I'm getting at as far as futility, so...
I'm sorry?
That's what I'm getting at as far as futility. I mean, the futile nature of pursuing it in that format.
Yeah, I don't understand what. Well, I didn't see in their appeal any challenge to actually any delinquency or deficiency in the pleading, on the face of the pleading or the evidence at trial that would show that it would have been futile. Obviously, demand would have been futile. There would have been no point or purpose in adhering to the Rule 2309 requirements. But you read their appeal, and that they didn't even raise that issue. The issue was one purely of standing. I thought whether we have an injury, and so that's how we respond. That's the injury. But I agree with you, and that is another point here in my outline, that to the extent that this is, that they're saying we had to adhere to Rule 2309, I think Rule 2309, futility of presentment, all of that is plainly established anyway, given the complete dominion and control that the wrongdoer, the fraudster in this case, Mr. Kaminsky, exercised over his alter ego entities. But we point out a line of cases, and I do want to raise one. They're cash out merger. They arise in other contexts, though. I mean, we point to the Wines v. Wines case. That's that was not a cash out merger. That was just simple breach of duty of loyalty, where controlling shareholder took everything and moved it to a new entity that was his own, and just zeroed the company and made it a shell. Right? That's not a cash out merger. That's just an end game breach of duty of loyalty, leaving a shell where you have a minority shareholder, one minority shareholder, who's injured, and the law recognizes we're not going to make you sue in the name of this shell entity where you're the only aggrieved person or shareholder.
As stated by Judge Bjorkman in Wines v. Wines.
Correct. And furthermore, in this Schneider case that came out July 31, which was after we submitted our briefing here, I would direct the court's attention to Schneider v. Schmidt, case number A22-1305. The Lexis site is 2023 MNAP Unpub Lexis 606. In that case, you have a controlling director who liquidates the assets of the company, diverts them without following adherence to distribution as required, but instead diverts them to a personal promissory note of some kind and gets sued directly for breach of fiduciary duty. This court said these are direct claims, not derivative. The entity has no independent injury, has no independent interest in those funds, because that entity, it was a nothing anyway. It was endgame anyway for the entity. And that's what we have here. This entity was always a facade, a sham, an instrument of fraud and wrongdoing. When the gamma loan funds and then the later refinance funds, everything was effectively liquidated, converted and transformed to cash, with the purpose and understanding that this entity was not a real entity, wasn't going to persist with operations into the future, and that money was going to go to Kaminsky's directly. In a circumstance like that, that's no different than a just absolute liquidation, cash out merger, however you want to call it. The injury is not to the entity. And as a practical matter, it makes no sense. Why would we force plaintiffs in a circumstance like this, where the defendant entity is a sham alter ego of the controlling director? Why would we force a plaintiff who's the only other shareholder, the only person who's ever contributed capital into this thing? Why would we force that shareholder to sue in the name of and for the benefit of the sham alter ego of the primary fraudster? It just makes the primary frauds, the entity, Talon OP, is not the victim that suffered injury. It is a defendant. It is the alter ego of the primary wrongdoer, Mr. Kaminsky, in this instance. On aiding and abetting, quickly, I think the questions asked previously show direct familiarity with the findings of the court and the evidence. Those findings are entitled to substantial deference. These are attacks on the factual findings of Judge Sandy, weighing the evidence, making his decision. And the evidence is substantial on knowledge and substantial assistance. I'd refer on substantial assistance quickly. I mean, there was direct knowledge. This isn't a red flag case. But on substantial assistance, I would refer the court to the Eighth Circuit's decision in the TD Bank matter. I'm sorry, I'm out of time, but I'd like to get this out there for you, if I may. AmBank, or American Bank of St. Paul v. TD Bank NA, 713 F3rd 455, Eighth Circuit 2013, in which the court affirmed the trial judgment of Judge Montgomery finding a bank liable for aiding and abetting liability when the bank knowingly and substantially assisted a fraudster slash customer in continuing to perpetuate or perpetrate a Ponzi scheme against a new and different victim bank. And there's the arguments raised there quickly, if I may.
Just sum up in the next few seconds.
Will do. The arguments raised in that case by that defendant, the defendant bank, they mirror what we're hearing here about inaction is not enough, right? Whatever. The court said participation is more than consent. And even inaction through consent or acquiescence, while that may be not enough for substantial assistance, active participation is more. Especially, and here, in that case, the defendant bank's participation allowed the transactions in question to consummate and conclude. And that's exactly what we have here. That's what Judge Sandy found. This was deliberate. Okay. That's what Judge Sandy held. Thank you.
Your time has expired, John.
Thank you.
And now, the appellants, how are you dividing your...
We'll split this up evenly,
okay.
Your Honor.
Sounds good. You may proceed.
Just briefly, on the aiding and abetting, on the substantial assistance piece, I think the court has to take a close look at the individual underlying tort, which is the breach of fiduciary duty, and the findings that the court had on what constituted Mr. Kaminsky's breach of fiduciary duty. And the fact that Mr. Wyrobek was not there to substantially assist many of those. A lot of the things that occurred were not on his watch. To the extent that the reliance was upon a vote for the 2017 refinancing the property, there was evidence that was presented as we need this money to retire some other debts. It was at a board meeting attended by counsel. So then you have to look about, did he know there was a wrongful purpose? And these elements are considered in tandem. So you cannot take you have to take a look at these instances and say, did you have substantial knowledge that there was a wrongful purpose by the underlying act? And then did Mr. Wyrobek take an affirmative step? Failure to act is not substantial assistance, and therefore you cannot get aiding and abetting liability. On the direct versus derivative issue, Your Honor pointed out that the argument there was a strong one. It's because it is. The injury here is to Talon. Talon was owned in part by Trek, which is in part owned by the public. So if there was a corporate, there was waste going on or misappropriation of corporate assets, it's not just Bren Road that is harmed. There are other people that have an interest in the viability and the value of Talon.
What's your response to the futility argument?
The futility is about the demand, right? So you have to make a demand on the corporation. The corporation may not ultimately pursue that case. But for Talon OP, I think it could have, if it wanted to, institute a special litigation committee to see whether or not the claim was even worth taking on. And so it's not about the demand here. It's about the injury. The analysis here is who was injured and who would recover the benefit of the recovery, and that is Talon OP. It is not all Bren Road. Bren Road, because of this judgment, got to see all of the recovery. That the injury was to the entity. If Mr. Kaminsky did, in fact, pilfer money or assets or waste assets, that harms the company. And the fact that they believe it was a sham, well, there's other parties that had ownership interests in this.
What other parties had ownership?
So Trek owned part of Talon OP. Let's say Talon OP was a nothing.
It's the Talon group, though.
Exactly. But yes, and Trek is an owner. Trek has owners. So the value of these interests in the company are perhaps devalued by the acts of Mr. Kaminsky, but that injures the entity. And so that's a classic, quintessential derivative claim. And with that, I'll let Mr. Gallatin finish up here. Thank you, Your Honor. We would ask that the court reverse and vacate the judgment with respect to Mr. Wyrobek.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Gallatin, you can have the last word this morning.
Thank you very much. I'll be just, I think, very, very quick. With respect to the piercing issue, given the opportunity but doesn't address, Victoria Elevators isn't actually addressed as Your Honor's referred to. I think calling it sparse is generous within the opinion. And I think we cannot overlook the fact that it specifically states disregard of the corporate entity requires that a number of the factors be proven. That is what you have to do for Victoria Elevator to be satisfied in order to get to a second half of, is this equitable? With respect to the motion to dismiss, I'd just like to note the trial court treated that allegation as a fact, and that it was not, that that fact wasn't proven. In fact, the court took the step to sort of disprove that that fact was pled versus treating it as a legal allegation. And I'd offer that this court ought not translate what the district court didn't do and treat it at the district court level as a factual allegation and convert that here to a legal conclusion that not need not be accepted. The final part to address, which was touched on, is the damages. So now all of a sudden we hear, here's why $14.5 million is right, because Gamma cashed out $23.5 million. What's not been submitted at the trial court level, though, was any indication that $14.5 million was ever in the mirror. There was not a contemplation of $14.5 million.
But what's wrong with the district court using the value of the real property in the absence of other evidence of the loss as sort of a proxy for the loss occasioned by the misdeeds here?
We don't know that that's what they did. We don't have an explanation. I would like to know.
I think the district court explained how it got there, took the value of the property and subtracted the consideration that Bren Road had received over time and said, you're left with $14.5 million loss here.
While I respect your reading of it, I do not read the order to identify that is the equation utilized as to how it was arrived at. Similarly, it's not the equation that was used by the party wanting $6.5 million in its submission at how to arrive at just $6.5 million, let alone to be given $14.5 million. So with all due respect to your reading, I don't read it the same, and I think that the order on the damages element lacks the explanation that we're justified to be able to have a collateral attack on the thought process and the analysis used at the district court level. We've been deprived of that, and that deprivation warrants us having the ability to address that at the trial court level, whether it be through some sort of new proceeding as to damages or an outright reversal. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Thank you, counsel. Thank you all for your helpful arguments. We appreciate the work you've put into bringing this complex case to our attention and explaining a lengthy history of litigation that's gone on for some years. So we appreciate your efforts, and we will take the matter under advisement, issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period.
Thank you, Your Honor.
That is the last matter on our calendar for oral arguments, so we are in recess.
All rise.